is Americana. My brother put me on composing occasional ballads. One was called The Lighthouse Tragedy. The other was a sailor's song on the taking of Teach, or Blackbeard the Pirate. They were wretched stuff, in the Grub Street ballad style, and when they were printed, he sent me about the town to sell them. The first sold wonderfully, the event being recent, having made a great noise.
The words you have just heard were from the autobiography of Benjamin Franklin. This program is Americana, the 11th in a series of radio essays on the American scene, presented each week by Northwestern University in cooperation with station WMAQ. Tonight, we bring you an American sampler.
Good evening. I'm Martin Maloney of the School of Speech at Northwestern University. About once a year in these happy days, someone or other publishes a collection of American folk songs. This time, the instigator of the volume is Burl Ives. Ballantine Books has just released a volume called The Burl Ives Songbook. You can get a paper-covered edition of this work for a very modest price, or if you prefer, a much handsomer copy in hardcovers for your permanent library. I'm always delighted at the appearance of such volumes as this one. Not very many years ago, the only people who bothered much about folk songs were a rather small group of eccentrics who collected folk music as a hobby. I think it's splendid that so many of us have rediscovered the pleasures of folk music in late years. For me, one of the principal charms of this sort of music is its power to recreate, with startling vividness, a fragment of the American past. For that reason, and because, after all, the only thing you can do with a song collection is to sample it, rather than read through it or even sing through it, I've tried tonight to make up a program of songs and spoken fragments, which I hope will recreate for you some moments in the American past and present. So we offer you an American sampler. Visualize, to relive colonial days in North America is difficult, I think, almost to the point of impossibility. The endless sweep and savagery of the continent, the mystery and wonder of the Indian inhabitants, the clash of nations and of personalities over the wealth of the New World. These things are unimaginable 4 centuries or so later, unimaginable and full of contradictions. And yet this world is in its way a familiar one when we touch it. It's possible, for example, to set against the barbaric colors and somber shadows of the New World that delicate and charming English ballad called Greensleeves.
Alas, my love, you do me wrong to cast me off discourteously, for I have loved you so long, delighting in your company. Green sleeves was all my joy, green sleeves was my delight, green sleeves was my heart of gold, and who but my lady green sleeves? Thy dress was of the grassy green, with sleeves of satin hanging by, which made thee be our harvest queen, and yet thou wouldst not love me. Green sleeves was all my joy, green sleeves was my delight, green sleeves was my heart of gold, and none but my lady green sleeves. Green sleeves, now farewell and adieu. God, I pray to prosper thee, for I am still thy lover true. Come once again and love me. Green sleeves was all my joy. Green sleeves was my delight. Green sleeves was my heart of gold. And who but my lady green sleeves?
Perhaps more within the stereotypes of colonial America is the figure of that rather shabby but magnificent adventurer, Captain John Smith, who won the heart of the Indian Princess Pocahontas. Captain Smith seems to have been an able soldier, a bold adventurer, a violent and rather irritable man, and above all, his own best publicity agent. The celebrated story of his rescue from the Indian chief Powhatan, Captain Smith wrote himself. You'll find it in his General History of Virginia.
At last they brought Captain Smith to Moronoconoco, where was Powhatan, their emperor. Here more than 200 of those grim courtiers stood staring at him as he had been a monster, till Powhatan and his train had put themselves in their greatest braveries. Before a fire upon a seat like a bedstead, Powhatan sat covered with a great robe made of rarakan skins, and all the tails hanging by. On either hand did sit a young wench of 16 or 18 years, and along on each side of the house were two rows of men, and behind them, as many women with all their heads and shoulders painted red, and many of their heads bedecked with the white down of birds. At Captain Smith's entrance before the king, all the people gave a great shout. The Queen of Appomattox was appointed to bring him water to wash his hands, and another brought him a bunch of feathers instead of a towel to dry them. Having feasted him after their best barbarous manner, the savages held a long consultation. Then two great stones were brought before Powhatan. Then as many as could laid hands on Captain Smith, dragged him to them, and thereon laid his head, being ready with their clubs to beat out his brains. But Pocahontas, the king's dearest daughter, when no entreaty could prevail, got his head in her arms and laid her own upon his to save him from death. Whereat the emperor was contented. Contented that he should live.
As I went out walking for pleasure one day, I got awful lonesome as the day passed away. I sat down a-musing alone on the grass, when who should walk by me but a sweet Indian lass. She come and sat by me, and took hold of my hand. Said, you sure be a stranger, out in a strange land. She asked me to marry, and offered her hand. Said, my pappy's a chieftain, all over this land. My pappy's a chieftain, and a ruler be he. I'm his only daughter, and my name is Mohi. I answered and told her that it never could be, 'cause I had a dear sweetheart in my own country. At home with relations, I tried for to see, but there wasn't a one like my little Mohi. And the girl I had trusted proved untrue to me. So I sailed back o'er the ocean to my little Mohi.
In his introduction to the Burl Ives songbook, Mr. Ives remarks that the popular songs of early New England were divided pretty well between hymns and the ballads which appeared on printed broadsides. These broadsides, he writes, were very popular in spite of the general tenor of the Bay Colony and in spite of the fulminations of men like Cotton Mather thundering out against foolish songs and ballads which hawkers and peddlers carry into all parts of the country. Ives adds that at least one rather distinguished American author took a hand in the composition of some of these broadsides. Benjamin Franklin writes in his autobiography,
"My brother put me on composing occasional ballads. One was called The Lighthouse Tragedy. The other was a sailor's song on the taking of Teach, or Blackbeard the Pirate. They were wretched stuff in the Grub Street ballad style, and when they were printed, he sent me about the town to sell them. The first sold wonderfully, the event being recent, having made a great noise."
Perhaps Mr. Franklin was right about the literary quality of these ballads. And yet some of these old topical songs have a very real charm to them. One of the best of the surviving pieces is called On Springfield Mountain. The lyrics of this song appear to have been written well before the Revolution. They describe, as you will see, the sad deaths of a young man and his fiancée, both as a result of snakebite.
On Springfield Mountain, there did dwell a lovely youth. I knowed him well, Terudy-U, Terudy-A, Terudy-U, Terudy-A. He scarce had mowed half around the field when an ugly serpent bit his heel. They took him home to Molly dear, which made her feel so very queer. Terudy-U, Terudy-A, Terudy-U, Terudy-A. Now Molly had two ruby lips with which the pison she did sip. Now Molly had a rotten tooth, and so the pison killed them both. Terudy-U, Terudy-A, Terudy-U, Terudy-A.
Franklin, as everyone knows, excelled at more things than writing broadside ballads. One of his minor achievements was to write in the year 1775 one of the most superb unmailed letters I have ever read. Franklin was an old friend and enthusiastic correspondent of William Strahan, a member of the British Parliament. The letter was addressed, though never dispatched, to Strahan. Carl Van Doren accounts for the writing of the letter in this way.
Sometime during the long day at the Committee of Safety or in Congress or earlier or later, the thought of Lexington and Bunker Hill came to him and of his friend Strahan, who had voted for the measures which led to the battle. And the thought became a letter, as in another man it might have become a lyric.
Philadelphia, July 5th. 1775. Mr. Strahan, you are a member of Parliament and one of that majority which has doomed my country to destruction. You have begun to burn our towns and murder our people. Look upon your hands. They are stained with the blood of your relations. You and I were long friends. You are now my enemy, and I am yours. Benjamin Franklin.
To match the intense emotion of this brief letter, one must go not to the other written documents, but to a song which derives from one of the early military triumphs of the colonists during the Revolution, the Rifleman's Song at Bennington.
Why come ye hither, invaders? Your mind with madness fills. There's danger in our valleys and there's danger in our hills. Oh, hear ye not the singing of the bugle wild and free? For soon you'll know the meaning of the rifle from the tree. Oh, the rifle in our hands will prove no trifle. You ride a goodly seed, you may serve another master. You forward come with speed, but you'll learn to back much faster when you meet our mountain boys and their leader, Johnny Stark. Lads who make but little noise, but always hit the mark with the rifle in our hands will prove no trifle. Have ye no graves at home across the briny water, that hither ye must come like oxen to the slaughter? If we the work must do, then the sooner 'tis begun. If flint and trigger hold but true, then liberty is won with the rifle. the rifle. In our hands will prove no trifle. You ride a goodly steed, you may serve another master. You forward come with speed, but you'll learn to back much faster when you meet our mountain boys and their leader, Johnny Stark. Lads who make but little noise, but always hit the mark with the rifle. The rifle. In our hands will prove no trifle. Have ye no graves at home across the briny water, that hither ye must come like oxen to the slaughter? If we the work must do, then the sooner 'tis begun. If flint and trigger hold but true, then liberty is won with the rifle. The rifle in our hands will prove no trifle.
Valley Forge, December 23rd, 1777. To the President of the Continental Congress. Sir, though I've been tender heretofore of giving any opinion or lodging complaints, yet finding that the inactivity of the army, whether for want of provisions, clothes, or other essentials, is charged to my account, not only by the common vulgar, but by those in power, it is time to speak plain in exculpation of myself. With truth, then, I can declare that no man, in my opinion, ever had his measures more impeded than I have by every department of the army. We have, by a field return this day, made no less than 2,898 men now in camp unfit for duty, because they are barefoot and otherwise naked. Since the fourth instant, our number fit for duty from the hardships and exposures they have undergone, particularly on account of blankets, numbers having been obliged and still are to sit up all night by fires instead of taking comfortable rest in a natural and common way, have decreased near 2,000 men. We find, gentlemen, without knowing whether the army was really going into winter quarters or not, reprobating the measure as much as if they thought the soldiers were made of stocks or stones, and equally insensible of frost and snow. But what makes this matter still more extraordinary in my eye is that these very gentlemen think that a winter's campaign and the covering of these states of New Jersey and Pennsylvania from the invasion of an enemy is so easy and practicable a business. I can assure those gentlemen that this is a much easier and less distressing thing to draw remonstrances in a comfortable room by a good fireside than to occupy a cold, bleak hill and sleep under frost and snow without clothes or blankets. However, although they seem to have little feeling for the naked and distressed soldiers, I feel superabundantly for them. And from my soul, I pity those miseries which it is neither in my power to relieve or prevent. It is for these reasons, therefore, that I have dwelt upon the subject. And it adds not a little to my other difficulties and distress to find that much more is expected of me than is possible to be performed, and that upon the ground of safety and policy, I am obliged to conceal the true state of the army from public view, and therefore expose myself to detraction and calumny. Signed, George Washington.
It seems almost incredible, reading these lines, that there should be another letter in the same hand, dated less than 5 years later, in which General Washington refused indignantly the offer of a king's crown. Meanwhile, of course, came Yorktown. General Cornwallis was indisposed and didn't appear to surrender personally. Nevertheless, the British troops laid down their arms as the British band played another old tune called The World Turned Upside Down. And the band of the Continental Army played Yankee Doodle. Mr. Ives' collection of songs ends somewhere back in the middle of the last century. And you may wonder, after you've finished looking through it, whether folk music of this sort actually died out before 1900. I think the answer is not entirely. There have always been a few wandering troubadours with a knack for making up songs and sometimes for improving on the old ones. And happily enough, some of these people still seem to be around. About the best example of this sort of person I can think of offhand is Woody Guthrie. Mr. Guthrie has stretched the wandering minstrel tradition a little bit by publishing some of his songs in a commercial way, but he has the feel of folk music for all that. Some years ago, Guthrie published an exceptionally interesting autobiography called Bound for Glory. Here's a brief section of it, which gives you some idea of how Guthrie's songs get composed.
This December night was bad for singing from joint to joint. The rain had washed some of the trash along the streets, but had chased most of the cash customers on home. My system was to walk into a saloon and ask the regular musicians if they'd like to rest a few minutes. And they usually was glad to stretch their legs and grab a cup of coffee or a burger. Then we took their places on the little platform and sung our songs and asked the customers what they'd like to hear next. Each joint was good for about 30 or 40 cents if things went just right, and we usually hit five or six bars every night. The ace high crowd looked pretty low. We nodded at Charlie the Chinaman, and he nodded back toward the music platform. The whole joint was painted a light, funny blue that sort of made your head spin whether you was drinking or not. All kinds of ropes and corks and big fishing nets hung around over the walls and down from the ceiling. Cisco turned a nickel machine around with its face to the wall while I flipped the strings of his guitar hanging on his back and tuned mine up to his. Then I waved at Charlie the Chinaman and he reached above the bar and turned on the loudspeaker. "Let's sing him one, so they'll know it ain't jukebox stuff," Cisco said. "Well, what'll we sing?" "The sailor boys are really wet. Got caught in the rain." I nodded and I started singing.
"Well, it's raining on the skid row, storming down in Birmingham. Oh, it's raining on the skid row, storming down in Birmingham. But there ain't no stormy weather gonna stop these boys of Uncle Sam."
"You tell him back there, bud. Let her reel, let her ramble. Hey, hey!"
"Oh, it's stormy on that ocean, windy on the deep blue sea. Stormy on that ocean, windy on the deep blue sea. Gonna bake them Nazis a chicken loaded full of that old TNT."
"Hey, bud, I ain't got no money, except just a little here to get me a burger and a beer. I'd give you a dime if I had it, but I tell you what, you just keep on singing that there song, huh?" A big, broad sailor was leaning his head over my guitar a-talking. "He's just now making that song up, ain't you, friend?"
"I woke up this morning, seen what the paper said. Yes, I woke this morning, seen what the papers said. Them Japanese had burned Pearl Harbor, and war had been declared. Didn't boil myself no coffee, didn't boil myself no tea, didn't boil myself no coffee, and I didn't boil myself no tea. I made a run for that recruiting office. Uncle Sam, make room for me."
The music poured out of the guitar and floated out through the loudspeaker. Everybody at the bar shook their glasses in time to the music. One man was a-tapping a nickel against the rim of his beer glass and grinning at his face in the big looking glass. The joint boomed with music and dancing, and Charlie the Chinaman stood behind the bar and smiled. Music turned a pretty bad night outside into a good, friendly, warm shindig on the inside.
And that probably is how a good many folk songs get composed, or how they did once. I like Guthrie's book and his songs for a number of reasons. One is that they preserve the past, warm and alive, as I think commercial popular music never quite does, and as the most serious sort of music is not supposed to do. But beyond that, folk music is intensely personal, where most of our modern entertainments are not. There's altogether too little of this sort of thing in our world, but the habit of folk song is not wholly lost. Every now and then you hear, unexpectedly, a song which nobody ever put on the jukeboxes or plugged on television. I heard of one the other day from Wynn Strachey. I think it's a wonderful composition. I'll ask him to sing it now in the pious hope that not too many months or years from now, it'll seem rather quaint. It's called Looking for a Home.
4 long years in the army, it never was a home. Take me back to Chicago town and never more I'll roam. I'm a looking for a home. 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 My first day in Chicago, I spent looking for a bed, searching all the avenues for a place to lay my head. I was looking for a home. I was looking for a home, home, home. I was looking for a home. I was looking for a home. A lady said, I have a room. I said, is that correct? She said, why, you can move right in if the dog does not object. I'm a-looking for a home. 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 Well, the first time I saw my bedroom, it had one bed and a chair. The next time I saw my bedroom, there were 4 guys sleeping there. I'm a-looking for a home. 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 Now, if anyone's asking for me, just tell them I feel swell. I spend my days in Lincoln Park, my nights on the Lake Street L. I'm a-looking for a home. I'm a-looking for a home, home, home. I'm a-looking for a home. I'm a-looking for a home.
The singer, Homer or Blondell or Guthrie, he has many names, touches the strings and makes a single chord. There are a dozen tunes in his head. Any one would fit. He stares at his listeners. Now what shall he sing about? The war? Old achievements they'd like to remember? The sorrows of love? All of a sudden a line comes into his mind. It seems to fit the pattern of an old tune. He smiles, strikes a stronger chord, and begins to sing.
I'm a-looking for a home. I'm a-looking for a home, home, home. I'm a-looking for a home. I'm a-looking for a home.
You have been listening to Americana, the 11th in a series of radio essays dealing with American history and American living, presented each week by Northwestern University in cooperation with station WMAQ. Americana is written and narrated by Martin Maloney. Direction is by John Brooklyn. Songs and ballads were by Chicago's well-known balladeer, Wynn Strachey. The quoted materials were read by Claire Baum and myself, Bill Griskin. The books mentioned on tonight's program were the Burl Ives Songbook, published by Ballantine Books, and Woody Guthrie's Bound for Glory, published by E.P. Dutton and Company. Additional quoted materials were from Wanful Gabriel and Williams, The American Mind, published by the American Book Company, and from The Treasury of the World's Great Letters, published by Simon & Schuster. If you wish to receive a list of the books discussed on this program, please send your name and address on a postcard to Americana, care of station WMAQ, Chicago 54, Illinois, and a free copy will be sent to you. This is the NBC Radio Network.